on the next one.
Welcome back to part two of this very special episode of Crypto Scam with another guest to continue our discussion of the scalability and the promises of Ethereum. With us for the rest of this episode is going to be the famous Jameson Lopp and his uncanny beard, who is now a systems engineer at Casa, a new startup in the space. Formerly, he was the systems engineer at BitGo. And thank you very much for joining me on this episode, Jameson.
Pleasure to be here for the first time.
Yeah, you're right. This is the first time I'm interviewing you. And we haven't seen each other lately. I haven't attended too many Bitcoin developer events. But your name did come up this past weekend as I was purchasing my new toy in the world of hardware. And you were instrumental to them in order to actually stress test the crypto key stack. So you want to do a quick shout out to them and a word on what I'm holding?
Yeah, I bought a bunch of the hardware metal storage devices out there and put them through the ringer, everything from like 2000 degree heat for a prolonged period of time to crushing with like 10 ton hydraulic press, and the crypto key stack held up the best to all of those things and even more environmental hazards like hydrochloric acid, rusting, all kinds of stuff. So if you're going to go with the metal, that's probably one of the best ones to do.
Yeah, no, that's great. Now, this is not a hardware wallet. This is simply a way you can preserve your private key in a non-destructible way, a lot better than writing it down on a piece of paper. So there you go. We got a little plug in there. So is that what you currently do, mostly physical stress testing, or you mostly focus on technical stress testing?
That was a kind of unique thing for me. I've never tried anything like that before, but I've read a number of reviews and a few stress tests of these metal devices, and I just felt like they didn't take it to the extreme that it really needed. So I think that I arguably put these into conditions that the normal user is not going to experience, but we like to think adversarially in this space.
Cool. So real quick, tell us about Casa, where are you? I'm assuming you are one of the co-founders of Casa as well.
Yeah, early employee. You could call me a partner, I suppose.
Tell us what your company does, or the company that you are associated with does, what your exact role is, and what is your general role in the Bitcoin ecosystem?
So at Casa, I'm doing similar stuff to what I was doing at BitGo, which is really helping build the infrastructure and think about all the back-end systems that we need, and then just thinking about security from a number of different perspectives of how can we facilitate these crypto finance transactions while minimizing the trust required. You know, obviously, users are going to be dealing with us and our software that we're providing, and there will be some trust, but we want to minimize that as much as possible while still helping the user be sovereign in what they're doing. And specifically, when we're targeting like user sovereignty, we want to be a non-custodial solution. We want the user to finally realize the promise of being your own bank in Bitcoin. And we're doing that by offering very user-friendly mobile app, but that is backed by the security that you get from hardware key management devices like Ledger, Trezor, KeepKey, what have you. So while you'll be using a mobile app to actually manage your wallet, see your balance, facilitate creating the transactions, the actual private keys themselves are going to be stored on geographically separated hardware key management devices. So it's really like a vault product where we're trying to make your wallet robust, not only against hackers, but against physical attackers and all types of other loss that can happen, even due to like user negligence. So that's kind of one of the things that we're going for, is lowering the barrier to entry, lowering the learning curve that's required to be your own bank.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for that background. And is it fair to call you, let's say, a Bitcoin core contributor?
From a technical standpoint, I mean, I've got three or four pull requests that were just trivial changes, usually stuff that I ran into while I was working on my own fork of Bitcoin Core, which is the Satoshi fork. So, don't have any major functionality that I've contributed there, but I am on the list of the 570 people who have code that's in the core repository.
Right. And from my point of view, it's hard for me to get, I want core developers, our top 20 engineers. I'm not really here to interview them. I want them working. Like, I need them to keep my Bitcoin safe and decentralized. And I know you are very well respected in the space. And I recently heard you on the Noted podcast talking about your adventure in setting up your Ethereum node. And I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into that specific conversation. So earlier in this episode, I talked with Stop and Decrypt, who is somewhat anonymous in the space. Not many people know much about him other than he writes pretty detailed research articles. And lately over the summer, he wrote several criticizing the technological scalability of Ethereum. Now, as I brought Stop and Decrypt for this interview, I found out that he's not actually a developer. He's more of a researcher. So I wanted to bring you on, and just for a more developer perspective, because my developer days are long behind me. I did have a degree in financial engineering. I used to look at code. I used to write amazing VBA code in the back of Excel. I'm telling you, my VBA skills were not ones to mess with, but that's as far as I really wanted to go. Started learning some Python and then realized, coding is not what I really want to do. So I'm actually going to pull up screen share and we'll jump right into the full topic. So the first article that he wrote, it was titled, "The Ethereum Blockchain Size Has Exceeded 1 Terabyte, and Yes, It's an Issue." This was written back in May, back at the end of May. We are now about to go into September. So it's been a good, 4 months?
Yep.
It's been a good 4 months since then. And it was a pretty lengthy and detailed article. I love the picture of Vitalik holding up that sign that everyone has been using. I think it's coming up there eventually. These are long articles, guys. I read all of them. It takes some time. So what do you think about that? And how did from a general point of view, how is the Ethereum blockchain getting so many transactions and where do you think it's going? And then we'll pick at the details of that.
Yeah. So, the 1 terabyte number is for what they call an archival node. Within Ethereum, there's more classes of node types and security models than you're going to find in Bitcoin. And that was the type, though, that I was running when we were operating infrastructure at BitGo, is this archival node. And basically that means that if you are starting off your node, and this requires using non-default parameters, by the way. The default is using a much more lightweight and lower security model. But if you do decide to do a full validating archival node where you start off from the Genesis block and you download every transaction that's ever happened and actually perform the calculations that do the state changes to the Ethereum state, then if you're lucky, maybe a week or so later, if you're running decent hardware, you will catch up and you'll get to the current tip of the blockchain. Now, you're only going to be able to do that if you're running pretty high-end solid-state disks that have a lot of disk throughput, simply because the calculations that are required involve reading and writing a lot of data from the disk. And if you get to the very end, then you'll end up with, over a terabyte of data. And that's because it's storing all of the different states that have ever occurred in Ethereum. There are, other options for you to prune those away. And I think if you end up doing pruning, then you'll probably end up with somewhere around 50 gigabytes of disk usage. But you'll still have had to do all of the reads and writes, which is what makes that initial sync incredibly slow. And like, you can't even do an initial sync from the Genesis block on Ethereum if you're using spinning disk hard drives, for example. You also can't do it if you're using a virtual private server that has a pretty low IOPS, or disk IO set to it. So the nodes that we were running at BitGo were fairly expensive to use, because this disk IO on virtualized servers is incredibly expensive. But I have done some tests on the opposite end, where I bought one of those like brand spanking new M.2 NVMe drives that's like a RAM drive. And I was able to do a full sync and validation of the Ethereum blockchain earlier in the spring, I think in a couple of hours. And that was with like a $2,500 computer that I built myself. So suffice to say that there is a lot more disk IO required to churn through the entire Ethereum blockchain in comparison to Bitcoin. And the way that they get around this is that on pretty much all of the Ethereum clients that I'm aware of, they will default to doing something called either warp syncing or fast syncing, where they're basically going out and they're getting a snapshot from usually like 30,000 blocks or so ago. I forget how many weeks or months that is. And then they will just start syncing and validating from that point in time. So, you could call this the like ask a friend model of, give me the state from a while ago, and then I will assume that the proof of work that chain is following is been valid up to that point, and that there's no invalid states before that, and we'll just go forward from there. And that's somewhat similar to like a Bitcoin SPV type of mode, though, where you do start doing more validation. You don't do it from the very beginning. So it's weird. It's kind of a hybrid security model. And then what we're going to get into, I think, talking later, is about the even crazier changes that are going to happen to Ethereum security model when we start talking about stuff like sharding and proof of stake.
Yeah, we're about to get into that. I'm just a little more curious on the costs, right?
Yeah.
And also, you said you did it in the spring. I think Ethereum has gotten a lot of transactions into their blockchain since the spring, because now we're going into the fall. What would your expectation be on costs, time costs, machine costs, just general? Let's say on January 1st, let's say going into 2019, what would you say would be a reasonable price cost and time cost to download, the full big boy Ethereum blockchain from Genesis Block?
Yeah, from... I don't keep as close a track as I used to, since I'm not operating these type of Ethereum nodes on a day-to-day basis anymore. But from what I have been seeing, it seems like the Ethereum blockchain has been basically maxed out for most of the year, while on Bitcoin, of course, as the price declined, the activity dropped off a lot, and very few blocks have been full on Bitcoin. But at the very least, if you're going to want to build your own machine that is running this, you're probably going to want to spend close to $1,000, because you're going to want to get really high-end solid-state drive and fairly high-end CPU to be able to churn through that. And this is, of course, assuming that you want to do the non-default full validation of the entire history. It gets a lot more expensive if you're doing this in an enterprise environment, like running virtual private servers. Those costs are going to easily run into, hundreds of dollars per month if you want to have sufficient disk IO to keep up with the blockchain. And what we find is that the releases of these new Ethereum clients tend to come out with performance improvements. And that's mainly because I think there's a lot of pressure on the Ethereum developers, because the enterprises are just running into issues where their nodes are falling out of sync, lagging behind, and it's resulting in operational headaches for exchanges and dApp makers, and really anyone who needs to be providing services that are up to date with the current state of the Ethereum blockchain.
Gotcha. But all of those costs you have just described, actually, let me drop screen share. So all of those costs that you just described, they're hardware costs. What about bandwidth and internet speed costs? Like, what minimum bandwidth do you need to download this thing, you know, in less than 6 months historically, and what bandwidth speed you need to be paying for in order to keep up with their 12-second blocks, I believe?
Yeah, well, the bandwidth isn't as bad because, you know, the block size on Ethereum, I think, equates to about 20 kilobytes. Now, of course, their block times are more like 15 seconds. But it's not so much the bandwidth of like downloading and uploading as it is the much more intensive disk operations where you're having to read and write data from arbitrary points on the disk every time a transaction comes in. You know, that could be requiring you to read data from a really long time ago. And that's why using spinning disks is just a non-starter, because they take like 10 milliseconds to go even find a point on the hard drive, whereas solid state is a lot faster in terms of the latency.
Gotcha. So what does this, like, how does this work for every single ICO that has launched on Ethereum? And how many of these ICO companies do you think are running their full Ethereum nodes, processing their own transactions, or are they relying on some centralized entity to do it for them?
I would suspect that very few of them are running, you know, fully validating nodes. It's just, you know, it's a lot more, it's costly in terms of money and time and operational expenses. But even beyond that, it's just, it's not the default. And really what you find in software in general is that defaults are very sticky. So even if they are running their own node, they're probably just you know, downloading Parity or Geth or whatever and running it with the defaults. And so that's doing like fast and warp syncing and skipping over the vast majority of validation.
Okay, so before we move on to the next article specific to sharding and POS, like, let's just say on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate Bitcoin, we say Bitcoin is decentralized. How would you rate that on a scale of 1 to 10? And then the same question to Ethereum. How would you rate Ethereum's decentralization on a scale of 1 to 10?
I hate trying to simplify it in such terms, because when we talk about centralization and decentralization, there's so many different ways you can measure it, so many different vectors. Now, and when I do it, it's, you know, it's going to be mainly from technical standpoint of like, what does the network of nodes look like? And, you know, from that standpoint, I think that there are a lot more fully validating nodes on the Bitcoin network. So it's thus much more decentralized than on Ethereum, where the Ethereum node count, if we're looking at like fully validating nodes, is much, much smaller. And I think is going to continue to decrease simply because the cost of running them will continue to increase.
Right. And that is actually my biggest, I try to look forward, and that is my biggest thing. I never felt the need to run my own Bitcoin node until the whole user activated soft fork kind of blew up in our faces, because no one expected the miners not to go along with something that everyone thought they should have been happy with. So the user activated soft fork experiment created a lot more node holders, and I think made the system a little more decentralized. And I think that going into the future, Bitcoin is being built out, the technology of Bitcoin is being built out as a way to encourage more people to run their own validating nodes. And everything I've seen so far in Ethereum is discouraging your ability to create your own node, decentralize the system, and process your own transactions. Would you agree with that generalization?
Well, yes, because it's a lot more difficult. It's a lot more challenging to build a system that is, you know, efficient at the base layer. Whereas there are a number of tendencies that push various people and developers and companies within these ecosystems to want to centralize different aspects of it, because centralization is tantalizingly easy, because you can get such greater performance gains by centralizing different aspects of the system.
Gotcha. All right, so let's jump over to how Ethereum plans to scale. And Ethereum has two things on their roadmap, and everyone is debating which one should happen first. And of course, they're going to meet in the middle and try to do both of them at the same time, which is probably going to create an even bigger disaster. So one of them is, of course, moving to a proof of stake system. And the other one is moving over to sharding. So I don't know, which one would you rather start with? If we start with sharding, please define sharding for us.
Yeah, from reading over stuff, they seem to want to tie them together because I think it will be simpler for them to do that. Do one big transition all at once rather than try to figure out how to do multiple different transitions.
All right, this is what the Bitcoin Core developers attempted to do with segregated witness and ran into a bit of a problem. And if those pieces were going to be done one at a time, maybe one of them would have created the big problem. So in hindsight, it's hard to say if that was the right way to do it or not. But now it's hindsight, and I think the way it was done was absolutely, it needed to be done.
Yeah. Yeah, so sharding in general technical terms is a fairly old concept. I actually first experienced sharding 10 years ago when I was working on a web application that was on the LAMP stack, so Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. And we had a MySQL database, and the company grew to the point that it just wasn't possible for that single server with that single MySQL database to continue to be able to process the load of our increasing number of customers. So what did we do? We sharded it. And by sharding, basically that meant that we created a bunch of new machines that had their own MySQL databases, and then there were just little pointers in a master database. And whenever a customer, started doing stuff with our web app, we would say, okay, this user has been assigned to this shard. So just send them over and do all the regular database operations, but do it on this one machine rather than on a single huge instance. And so it's a fairly straightforward way of doing quote-unquote horizontal scaling, where you can just buy more machines, you throw more machines at the problem. That ends up being a lot more cost-efficient than vertical scaling, which means you still have like one machine or a few machines, and you just buy increasingly more powerful ones, but they become exponentially more expensive to do so. Now, in a decentralized environment, this still makes sense from a performance standpoint, because you're basically spreading out the load more widely across a larger number of machines. But the trick, the kind of downside, is how do you do this without changing the security model of the system? Because we currently in Bitcoin have a single blockchain, and if you're running a full node, then you're downloading all the data, validating it yourself, and it gives you this amazing security model people often refer to as trustless, where the only real security assumption is that you at one point in time have connected to one other honest node on the network. Even if you're connected to 100 nodes and 99 of them are lying to you, then that one honest node will get the data to you that you will be able to authoritatively say yourself, this is the correct data and everyone else is lying to me. But if you're on a network where you're only downloading 1% of the data, then the other 99% could potentially be lying to you by omission, and you're just never receiving the data. So it becomes a lot trickier to retain a strong security model in a system where you're not looking at all the data yourself.
Oh, that's very informative, but that's the security and the omission of data perspective. So Stop and Decrypt specifically makes the point that sharding can actually centralize your system. I don't know if you had a chance to deep dive into this article, but what are your general thoughts on just centralization in general because of sharding.
Yeah, and you know, I've spent a number of hours reading through as much of the technical documentation around proof of stake and sharding that are currently available in Ethereum. And I remember when you were first asking me about this about a month ago, I said, you know, I'm really not comfortable talking about it because I don't understand it very well. And since then, I've spent a fair amount of time, probably at least 6 hours so far, reading through the various blog posts and FAQs. Both on ETH Research and Vitalik's blog and Twitter and whatnot.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about that, Jameson.
No, no.
I didn't mean to kill some of your brain cells. I really need them to continue programming Bitcoin.
No, this is good. I mean, you know, learning is always good. But what I would say is that at least, you know, 6 or so hours into it so far, I'm not sure that anyone really understands the proof of stake and sharding in Ethereum, because I don't think it's done. And the reason why I say that is, like, you actually go to the FAQ for sharding on ETH Research website, and there's a note near the bottom that says, you know, this is only about 70% done, and then it lists a lot of things that have not yet been fully finalized, and that includes a fair amount of the game theory around, like, how they're going to penalize bad actors or even find bad actors in the system. And so suffice to say that within Ethereum moving to this proof of stake model, they're implementing a ton of new game theory. That's not necessarily bad. I mean, you could make an argument that Lightning Network is implementing a ton of new game theory, but they're also introducing just an enormous level of complexity at the base layer. And there are things, and there's a lot of unanswered questions of, you know, how are you going to have good guarantees? Mainly, or what I'm worried about is the cross-shard communication of, like, how do you guarantee, or at least have some sort of probabilistic guarantee that transactions and data that occur on one shard correctly make it over to another shard. And they're trying to do that by using a lot of, like, pseudo-random sampling from the validator set to say, okay, you know, each shard has 150 validators and they're randomly assigned, so it's hard to game the system. But there's still, I think, deeper level issues in how they're going to do the, like, the actual load balancing of the data across the shards. And so there's a number of things that could go wrong. Like, if the activity on one shard got really out of whack, really high, and another shard was really low, you can start running into throughput issues. And the reason why this is the case is that you should basically think of each of these shards as being the same as what the current Ethereum blockchain is like. So we can expect that they will be able to do, at a best case, maybe 15 transactions per second. So what happens when one shard starts trying to do 100 transactions per second, and then some other neighbors that are only doing 1 or 2 transactions per second are trying to communicate with it? So it's just an issue of, you know, increasing levels of complexity by orders of magnitude, and of course the fact that this is something that has been researched for, I think, 4 or so years now. And if you look at Vitalik's recent tweet storm that was 70 something tweets long, he went through the whole history of it, and it's pretty clear that this is still a work in progress. They're still trying to figure out the optimal scenario, and it's, you know, it's not clear whether or not there is an optimal scenario, and it's even less clear, like, what all the trade-offs are going to be. But it is certainly clear that if you are running a fully validating node on Ethereum right now, it is going to become exponentially more expensive to be what I'm seeing referred to as a top-level node, because the top-level node would have to validate not only the current Ethereum blockchain, but then the Beacon chain and all of the shard chains, which I'm also seeing conflicting information about. But it seems like they're currently targeting 1,024 shards. So 1,024 instances of the Ethereum virtual machine potentially doing 15 transactions per second. So say, you know, throughput maxes out around 15,000 transactions per second. You're going to need a Craig Wright level node, you know, a $20,000 something odd node in order to be able to validate all of that stuff yourself. And I think almost nobody is going to be doing that.
Well, we both know Craig Wright might do it, but no, but it's really funny that you mentioned that because I finally met Craig Wright for the first time. This was recently, probably a couple of months ago when I was in London. I was visiting London. Some of the guys put together a dinner because I was in town. They invited Craig Wright for fun, and he said yes. And as funny as that conversation went, I was sitting next to him all throughout the dinner of like 10, 15 people at the table. Him and I agreed on everything except what is Bitcoin. Like we can sit there across the table from each other and like talk shit about Ethereum all day. Yeah. Like he hates this thing as much as I do or many other Bitcoin maximalists do. So there is some commonality even with, you know, when you do it, if you ever do end up sitting at a table with Craig Wright and you want to find some commonality, start talking about some of these altcoins, and it's actually it can be pretty enjoyable conversation to say the least. I know people are still mad at me for saying this, but yeah, it was fun. Well, like listening to him talk about how bad Ethereum is, it was actually pretty interesting. But then, so the other thing I was going to say is I remember I was actually at the very first scaling event in Montreal. I believe it was in 2015. I'm not sure if you were there. I don't believe you were a speaker.
That was the only one I didn't make it to.
Okay. So I thought, my memory is pretty good, but I don't remember meeting you there. So that's when Vlad Zamfir introduced sharding for the first time and spoke about it publicly on stage. That was 2015. So I still remember that. And I remember all the discussions that took place kind of after that. All right. So let's change gears slightly and stick with the proof of stake mechanism. Now, you're not an economist, and there will be an Ethereum part 4. This is an Ethereum part 3, guys. In part 1, we talked about the regulatory problem of Ethereum, with it being a security, the way it was financed. In part 2, Johnny Dilley and I discussed the concept of smart contracts and why smart contracts don't really need to be decentralized, because that doesn't make any sense. There's no censorship in your contract. Just maybe the money that you need to pay for those contracts. This is focused on the technology. So I will bring up the proof of stake conversation in my fourth episode, which is going to focus on economics, hopefully with an actual economist, why proof of stake is more of either a communist system or more of a, you know, you just get free Ethereum for holding Ethereum system. But from a technological perspective, what do you think about proof of stake versus proof of work? I find it hard to apprehend how people are taking proof of stake seriously. The technological innovation of Satoshi Nakamoto's blockchain was proof of work. That is the innovation. Like proof of stake, it's been done for in forever. Like where is the innovation? Where's the technological innovation of proof of stake?
Right. So a lot of people, of course, get upset about proof of work because they consider it to be a waste of energy. They consider it to be harmful to the environment. And, you know, you can come up with all kinds of metrics to make an argument that from an energy efficiency standpoint, Bitcoin is less efficient than any number of other financial systems. But the thing about proof of stake that is appealing to people is that, you know, they can be running their system basically without requiring any sort of inputs, you know, externalities, I guess, if you will. They have their fully self-enclosed ecosystem that nobody else can screw with. The downside is that you run into a number of problems of incentive. And of course, I always end up going back to Andrew Polstra's proof of stake versus proof of work paper from years ago, in which he was making arguments that, you know, long range attacks are the primary problem that you run into within a proof of stake system. And actually Vitalik himself has referenced this on a number of occasions, and he called it the nobility problem. And this basically means, like, if you ever have a point in time where someone controls an inordinate proportion of the value of the system, they can always, in the future, even if they sell off all of the value that they have, they can always do a long-range attack that starts from that point in time and rolls forward. And so this was actually a way that a number of the early naive proof-of-stake systems worked or were attacked, is that, you know, someone would just go back in the blockchain weeks or months after they had already sold off all their coins, and then said, okay, I'm creating a new chain from this point in time when I held a lot of money. And you can basically rewrite history at no cost, because you know, your CPU can be generating these blocks, probably hundreds of blocks per second, because there's no real proof of work required. So what ends up happening is that you start creating this sort of Rube Goldberg machine to deal with all of the new edge cases that come from nefarious things that a proof of stake attacker could do. And actually, if you look at Vitalik's tweet storm that I was talking about, he concedes that they ended up abandoning trying to solve the long range attack problem, and they just introduced a new security assumption, which is that, you know, we will just make it so that no client will ever accept blocks that are more than, like, I think 20 or 30,000 blocks old. So we just kind of, you know, have an implicit type of checkpoint there. And, you know, maybe that's good enough. It's really hard to argue about this because you can't really know whether it's good enough until it gets attacked and it fails. And so really what you find, if you're looking at like the current cutting edge state of proof of stake research, is that they're trying to figure out how to do the best slashing conditions, which is a fancy term for saying penalization conditions, and trying to figure out how to only penalize the bad actors without penalizing good actors who like accidentally went offline for a while and stopped doing their job. You start going down this rabbit hole that gets insane, and that's like why they've been still doing this research and pivoting for the past 3 or 4 years now. Maybe it is a solvable problem, but as far as I and most of the other people I talk to can tell, it still has not been fully solved. But, you know, kudos to Vitalik and Vlad and all the other team for keeping at it. You know, maybe they will finally solve it, and we'll be able to make all of the tree huggers happy, and everybody can switch to a proof of stake system, and we don't require any more electrical generation to go on. But of course, there's plenty of counter arguments to that. You know, I would say Bitcoin actually incentivizes people to find cleaner, more efficient forms of power generation.
Yeah, that's always been the argument that I have been trying to use, in that Bitcoin will drive the innovation in not only energy generation and energy consumption, but also, you know, thermodynamics and, let's say, cooling of your heated equipment. Like there could be so much innovation there that I'm really looking forward to. So this is the paper that I have on the screen right now that you're referring to from Andrew Polstra, correct?
That's the one.
All right, so I'll throw that in the video description. I don't know if I'm going to go out searching for their Twitter war, but please, I encourage you to go and do that. So because of all of these concerns, and it sounds like they're still researching this thing, does that explain this amazing Google search of Ethereum delays the difficulty bomb? And once again, continuously, because I thought that Ethereum was supposed to be on a proof of stake system a year ago, and what was going to force them to get there was this difficulty bomb rendering their mining useless, and they continue to delay it. Any thoughts on this? What have you heard anything? What's the latest news? Is it going to be, is it like the debt ceiling that gets us delayed?
Exactly. It's like, you know, what's the point in even having a debt ceiling or a difficulty bomb? Like, we all know that you're not going to let your network commit suicide because you did not reach a technical achievement in the time that you thought was going to happen. And, you know, it's not, it's, there, I'm not going to like criticize them for saying that, you know, they should have gotten it done by now. It's like when you're doing stuff that nobody's ever done before, it's really hard to come up with time frames. I think it's weird that they keep putting this difficulty bomb back in. I mean, why not just take it out so that you can admit that we don't know how long it's going to take to get to where we're going? I don't know. It's kind of a weird aspect of it. You know, like they've already set the precedent that whenever they get close to the difficulty bomb, it's going to get taken out. At this point, it's hard to say when they're going to be willing to do a full transition to proof of stake. And, you know, the story keeps changing, it seems like, on an annual basis. So I would be surprised if we're sitting here a year from now and they have completed the transition. But maybe a year from now, it will be in sight and it will be scheduled.
But like, I still have a conceptual difficulty believing that they can ever go to proof of stake. I mean, Ethereum, even though it's down like 90% or whatever, one Ethereum is still like $100 to $200. And I believe they're mining three Ethereum every 12 to 15 seconds, whatever their blocks are. So how do you just show up and tell, you know, a giant mining facility that's invested millions of dollars to just point their hardware somewhere else?
Yeah, I think a few things could happen. We very easily could end up with, you know, another Ethereum Classic situation. Or maybe Ethereum Classic, you know, becomes much greater and a lot of the proof of work transitions over there. But, you know, also there's, I think, quite a few other altcoins that can be GPU mined, and they might be able to soak up a lot of that demand. But there was actually, I think, a meeting very recently in which it seemed like there was pretty strong consensus to decrease the mining reward in Ethereum. So we may see a decrease there, you know, another economic disincentive for proof of work miners to stick with Ethereum.
Yeah, no, I've always said for probably a couple of years now, I envision another Ethereum. We already have ETC. ETH will stay with Vitalik because wherever he goes, he's trademarked for ETH. And I envision an ETW, Ethereum Work, where the miners are going to try and convince all of the current ICOs to stay on the Ethereum proof of work chain. I think it will be a little challenging to get your ICOs to convert to another blockchain like an Ethereum Classic, like an EOS, like a Tezos or a Waves or all of them. And lately I've been saying these ICOs that become platforms for other ICOs, like all the ones I just named, they're going to be totally fungible, and your company's unlicensed security in the form of your ICO can just transition from one to the other, with all of them slowly becoming technologically unstable over time until some centralized solution shows up. Or at this point, I think Ethereum would almost be better served as a centralized, scalable solution to run all of these ICO smart contracts, because none of these ICO smart contracts are actually decentralized. They're centralized by the company creating the ICO. So wouldn't it make better business sense for Ethereum to centralize their product and offer their services for a fee of moving all of the stock around, like all of these securities around?
Maybe. I mean, so there's, of course, the Ethereum Enterprise Alliance could potentially, you know, create their own network for that. It seems to me like, you know, stuff like EOS, which is even more centralized, but has much greater capacity for throughput, could pick up a lot of this ICO slack. But kind of a counterpoint, though, for the incentives is that if a lot of these ICOs are holding a lot of value in Ether, then they could be incentivized to switch to a proof of stake system. And basically Ethereum would become secured by the ICOs themselves.
Yeah, no, that is an interesting thought to consider. And it's also great that you said EOS is, you know, more centralized with a lot more throughput. And that makes sense because decentralization comes at a cost. It comes at a security cost and it comes at scalability cost. You have to weigh those costs, and Bitcoin isn't willing to budge on decentralization side of the equation, and which is why the focus is on the Lightning Network and scaling your transactions as a second layer protocol, as long as that second layer protocol can be just as decentralized, probably even more fungible and anonymous, and have a lot more transaction throughput, and then it's a done deal. Bitcoin can actually scale.
Well, maybe it all just comes down to marketing.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. All right, any final general thoughts? I mean, you remember the DAO. I mean, I'll give the floor to you as far as, you know, the technology and the competency of the Ethereum. I know developers don't like to talk bad about other developers. Mm-hmm. I once asked Eric Lombroso on a live interview the following question. I didn't want to put him on the spot. I said, are there any altcoin developers that you truly respect? And he avoided the question. I think I meant it specifically in the case of Bcash, but I'm not going to go there. But is there anything else you want to talk about from the DAO hack, from the Parity wallet hack, from the MyEther wallet hack, to anything else you think that, why do people continue to trust the technology underlying Ethereum with these grand hopes that just almost that just aren't deliverable?
Yeah, well, it's just a very different mindset. And, you know, as I look out across this diverse ecosystem of different networks, I also see a diversity of different perspectives and ideologies. And in general, I think it's fair to say that Ethereum is a much more social network, you know, social ideology. And that's why Vitalik and a lot of the other developers are willing to make certain trade-offs with regard to consensus, where they're turning it into more of a social consensus of saying, you know, we're going to have a bunch of fairly well-known actors that are going to be, you know, putting skin in the game. And then we're just going to try to figure out how to help coordinate these actors. And that's a stark contrast to a Bitcoin style ideology, where it's more like, you know what, we have the protocol, and everyone is either going to follow the protocol or they're going to fork off, and you know, you get burned if you don't stay in consensus with everyone else. So I think that, you know, a lot of these things, they're valid, and it's hard to make, you know, technical arguments about them that necessarily convince people who have that other perspective. And I just take a very long-term view on it of, you know, these things are going to get attacked, and the ones that survive were good enough, and the ones that die were obviously not good enough. And that's, you know, time is going to have the ultimate say in which of these perspectives is workable.
All right, and one more question I forgot to ask earlier. As you read over the two articles by Stop and Decrypt, was there anything there you disagreed with? Was there anything there you felt was inaccurate?
Well, you know, I first read it when he first published it, and I didn't know whether or not it was accurate. But then, you know, I went back recently and read a lot of the technical FAQs and stuff from Ethereum developers, and I would say that my perspective is about the same as his, that ultimately this new type of system creates a much smaller number of players who are able to actually validate the whole system, and it results in the regular end user having to trust the system a lot more. And also, you know, the main point that I think he was making is that, unlike in Bitcoin, if you're running one of these nodes in Ethereum, especially once it gets sharded, you can't reject anything that goes wrong. You just have to go along with what you're told. And so it once again, it comes down to these like very different perspectives, I guess, and how the network should operate and how the developers extend them over time.
And I'll let you go on this one as a long time Bitcoiner, as a developer within the blockchain space. Would you ever build anything on top of or combined with Ethereum, or advise anyone that it's actually a good idea?
Nothing that you want to scale out, to be a mainstream application. Now, if you actually look at one of Casa's recent blog posts, we are going to add Ethereum support, and that's because we have wealthy clients who will pay us to add Ethereum support. But we are actually in a conundrum because I spent over a year at BitGo working on Ethereum wallets and Ethereum infrastructure, and it was a nightmare for a number of reasons, and I wrote a very lengthy blog post about that. And I really want to avoid trying to do multi-sig in a smart contract again, because like some of the stuff that you were mentioning, there's no real guarantees. There's very poor auditability and correctness proofs, anything like that. And so if we're going to be doing multi-sig in Ethereum, we want to have some sort of assurance that, you know, if there is a bug in the smart contract we're using, that the entire network is going to fork to fix it. Otherwise, you know, what guarantees do we have? We don't want to end up in another parity situation.
All right, Jameson, thank you very much for coming on this third episode of Ethereum's Crypto Scam, where we dove deep into the technology and the scalability of Ethereum.
My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, guys, if you really like the show, there will be more to come. I am bringing back Crypto Scam slowly. This Ethereum series really got me stuck. I tried completing the technology of Ethereum is unsustainable over a year and a half ago, and I had a big problem getting the right guests. Those guests have finally arrived, and hopefully the show will flow going forward. Of course, you can check out all of my other podcasts on the Tone Vase YouTube channel and the Tone Vase audio podcast stream. See you all on the next episode of Crypto Scam.